Welcome to Living Healthy Together. Today we're talking about hypertension, also known as high blood pressure. It's something that's incredibly common across the country. And recently at Central Vermont Medical Center, they held a two-day screening event for folks to come in to get screened for high blood pressure and to get information and support for how to either maintain or regain healthy blood pressures. We're joined now by Allison Hobart, a family nurse practitioner in Waterbury at CVMC, and Rachel Lorick, a registered dietitian, clinical nutritionist, and the director of food and nutrition services at CVMC. Thank you both for joining us today. Allison, I want to start with you because you're a primary care provider. What kind of conversations do you have with patients around high blood pressure? Is it something that you see a lot in the community? Something that every doctor everywhere probably sees a lot? Give us a little foundation here. Ground us in what's going on.
Hypertension, high blood pressure is really the most common chronic condition that we encounter in primary care. It's sort of at the cross section of so many different health problems. I guess I would say that it's also probably the most modifiable risk factor for heart disease worldwide. And when I say modifiable, I mean something that we can really do something about, both from a prevention standpoint and interventions once high blood pressure has developed in our patients. And we can really directly reduce the instance of heart disease, meaning heart attack, stroke, even associated kidney failure, and more peripherally, even dementia by managing high blood pressure.
So an incredibly common thing, but a lot of agency for people to take action, either on their own or in partnership with their primary care provider. If you've listened to the show before, you'll know that I love giving people ways to take action and things that they can do to make a positive impact. Rachel, since this is such a common chronic health concern, what do you see in the hospital? How does this impact what you do?
I think that a lot of our patients and community members, they already know that they should eat healthier, but there's barriers that they're really facing. And not even just within our community, it's just so common in the world right now, the cost of food, the time to cook food, transportation to the store, and just stress alone, it often leaves a where do I begin mindset. And so with educating our patients when they come in, and if they're on a heart healthy diet and they're on a sodium restricted diet, they often don't know that they can eat all of the foods that they already enjoy. It's down to the cooking process. It's down to what seasonings to use instead of salt. Those simple fixes, really, and they can enjoy all of the foods that they already love. It's so important that we educate our patients and our community members on taking a new approach. And so, yes, it's very common that patients come in with high blood pressure and they're often on a low sodium diet or a heart healthy diet. And we really want to show them that they can eat all of their favorite foods. It's just educating them on how they can do that.
It's a really exciting thing to hear as someone that loves to eat. I'm either eating or I'm thinking about eating. Those are my two states of beings. Allison, the way that you live makes an impact or can make an impact on your blood pressure, even if you already have high blood pressure. Take us through the other side of this coin, approaches that involve or rely upon medication. How do these things work together? Do they work together, or are they completely separate from each other?
Oh, absolutely. They work together. And I would say, just to comment on Rachel's point about helping people feel like they don't have to give up food so much as just make some adjustments to the way that they enjoy them. That is always part of the conversation I have with patients. And I think for many years, people have come into a primary care appointment, and the first thing that happens is they get on the scale, and that starts people off feeling a little bit disappointed a lot of the time, or negative about the way the appointment is going to go. And so by the time I get into the room, people already have some feelings about whether they're going to be getting good news or bad news. I would say most of us would say we would really rather manage our health with the things that we do to prevent problems than ending up taking pills. And I get a lot of people who say, you know, I look at my mom and my dad and they have a big, long line of pill bottles, or they have a big pill box on the counter, and the first thing they have to do in the morning is take these pills. I don't want to be that guy. I don't want to follow in that path. And what can I do to avoid it? So we get to have a conversation of how medication and lifestyle work together to help prevent the problems associated with high blood pressure, heart disease, and some of the adjacent medical conditions that can go along with that. So to go back to your original question, where does medication come in? We measure blood pressure with two numbers, a top number over the bottom number, or systolic over diastolic, if we want to get technical. If people's blood pressures are consistently over 140 on the top and 90 on the bottom, we really do need to intervene with a medication to get it down to a risk reduction right away. And you can add lifestyle approaches at the same time to get a more robust response. But there's this great spot before the 140 over 90 where people are more in the 130 over 85 range, where you can go really 3 to 6 months working on the lifestyle aspects and see what kind of a reduction you get in blood pressure. And that can depend on how motivated people are, also things that we have less control over, like food security and the time and the space and the stress reduction to make some of the changes. But I always want to give everybody a chance, if we can, to go without medication and then adding it if we need to, or if we're beyond that already at the point that I'm intervening, then maybe we start with meds and lifestyle. And if lifestyle goes really well, maybe we can reduce or take away a med completely. It's really a team approach as far as I'm concerned.
Rachel, on the show before, we've talked about the food as medicine concept or philosophy. It's something that's backed up by research. How do you incorporate food as medicine into the way that the hospital supports folks with high blood pressure and then provides education when they're on their way back to their lives?
That's a great question. To me, food as medicine means recognizing that access to nourishing food is foundational, really, to our health. Food impacts our energy levels. Food really shows if chronic disease is going to be in our lives at some point, depending on our diet. If there's any inflammation happening in our body, heart health, blood sugar, really just our overall well-being. And that's why programs like our Healthcare Shares and Veggie Van Gogh that we have within our community are so meaningful, because they really help our patients and our community members connect with fresh, nutritious foods in a way that's accessible and approachable and supportive. Food is medicine. Diet is medicine. We could be eating plenty of calories but still be malnourished if we're not eating calories that are nutrient dense, if we're eating calories that don't have the potassium that we need, the fiber that we need, the protein that we need, the vitamins and minerals. And I can go on and on. We really just need to make sure that the bites that we take are fueling our body and giving our body the energy it needs to do its job. It's just keeping us alive and healthy and well. So it's pretty incredible what the network is doing in general with partnering up with different nonprofits and community initiatives to really ensure that not only are we just educating our patients, but we're making sure that they're going home with resources to prevent them from going through the same cycle again if they were just in the hospital and were malnourished. We want to make sure that they have resources to prevent that from happening again.
And we'll link to those resources that you've mentioned, Healthcare Shares and Veggie Van Go. There are a couple other ones that I think we want to mention as well. Hunger Free Vermont, Three Squares Vermont. Rachel, can you talk a little bit about what those programs are? Are those focused specifically on food insecurity?
Hunger Free Vermont, we actually had them table at our hypertension awareness event because we can do all of the educating that we want on how to eat well and what that looks like. But if those that we are educating don't have access or don't have the means to be able to go out and purchase those items, we're not going to make an impact at all. So having them there is so important, and they provide the resources that folks need to get signed up with on Three Squares Vermont, which is three square meals a day, essentially is what it stands for, which is SNAP benefits, which provides money to folks to be able to purchase groceries. And that's everything, to be able to purchase your fresh foods, your fruits, your veggies, your protein, everything that you need, right? You need that before you can start educating somebody on how to eat well. They need to have access to eat well in order for them to eat well. And so that table was extremely important to have at the event. We don't want anybody to feel embarrassed to get the resources that they need, or perhaps it's very overwhelming where to start, where to begin. And so we wanted to make sure that we had everything there for them at those events.
Allison, we've talked a lot about food as a really important choice that people can make. What are the other modifications or lifestyle changes that people can make that are important and that are super effective?
If people wanted to research some of the dietary things, an easy one that has lots of studies to back it up is what's called the DASH diet. Dietary approaches to stop hypertension. It has all of the features of the things Rachel mentioned in terms of high in fruits and veggies and potassium, low in sodium, good amounts of fiber and protein. And it really, even though it's called a DASH diet, it's not a diet in the old school meaning of the word, but just a way to eat. It's not something you have to go on and lose a certain amount of weight, but just a way of approaching how you want to nourish yourself. And so adding exercise, the general standard is 150 minutes a week of moderate exercise, like taking a walk, and a couple days a week, even 10 to 20 minutes of more resistance training, like weights or body weight exercises, really covers what you need for the exercise aspects. We know that cutting down or stopping alcohol absolutely affects blood pressure and improves it. I know that's not always the most popular suggestion, but it's not black and white. It's not that you have to quit. Even if you decrease it, it makes really good positive impact. Quitting smoking, of course, is important for all aspects of cardiovascular health and lots of other parts of health as well. And we do have, in addition to those community partners that you and Rachel talked about, we also have available through UVMMC and CVMC in our neck of the woods, community health team partners who we can refer our patients to work with a registered dietitian one-on-one for specific advice, a health coach for how do I really work on my whole lifestyle, social work to help people access some of those programs if they would like some financial support or just more education and information, quitting smoking support. So there are lots of ways that we can help our patients in those other aspects of lifestyle in addition to the ones we've already talked about.
So much actionable information here. This is my dream. We've talked about what people can do, what they should do, the good stuff that's out there to help them. What about the pitfalls? Let's talk about what people should avoid. What are the things people need to know don't work and they shouldn't waste their time on?
I would say, I'm not going to call out any particular platforms, but just understand that people without medical or dietitian credentials who are trying to sell you any kind of supplement, and it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. And anything that you're thinking of spending money on, particularly supplement-wise, run it by your primary first, because I see a lot of people who've sunk a lot of money into things that really are the equivalent of snake oil. And, you know, I hate letting them down when they're excited about them, but sometimes they're not only not useful, but dangerous.
I think sometimes people get into these ruts because they know that the work is going to be hard, and so they're trying to find a way to make it a little easier. And like anything else, you probably can't make the work easier. You have to do the work.
Yeah, just to echo what Allison said, there's so much misinformation online, and it's really important to seek guidance from trusted healthcare professionals. Social media, unfortunately, can push extreme diets, which creates fear around food. And we don't want anybody to feel fearful when it comes to eating. And so that's why it's so important to really discuss with your providers how to go about eating and speak with a registered dietitian. Health doesn't have to be all or nothing. You can still enjoy all of your favorite foods. It's just showing you everything in moderation and how to really prepare your food so they're well and individualized for you.
Time for a quick break here on Living Healthy Together. Thank you, Allison. Thank you, Rachel, for joining us, talking about hypertension and high blood pressure and sharing all of these great resources. When we come back, we'll talk with experts in occupational therapy, health and wellness, tobacco treatment, and more, and hear about how new high blood pressure guidelines could change your experience at your next primary care appointment. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Living Healthy Together, where today we're talking about high blood pressure and what it means for people in their everyday life. We're joined now by Vicky Delmas and Amy Rainville. They're both provider outreach specialists. Vicky works at CVMC. Amy works at UVM Medical Center. Vicky is an occupational therapist, and Amy is a board-certified health and wellness coach and tobacco treatment specialist. So a lot of things wrapped up with heart health, with nutrition, and with lifestyle management. Thank you both for joining us. Let's jump right in and talk about high blood pressure guidelines. They're getting a little bit stricter about how they react when they see certain numbers. What is happening, and how are people going to maybe see and feel different things when they go to see their primary care provider?
You know, when I went to school, I'm dating myself probably, but when I went to school, we learned that normal blood pressure was 120 over 80. And actually, back in 2017, that number changed because of new research, because the American Heart Association and the American College of Cardiology found that there was a correlation with cardiovascular impact, even at lower pressures. It used to be high blood pressure was 140 over 90, but they found that even at lower pressures in the 130s, there can be damage. So the numbers were rolled back. And now normal is less than 120 over 80, and high is considered 130 over 80. And the reason they did that is so we can intervene earlier and prevent some of the damage rather than waiting till people were more advanced in the disease. Practical. So that's a little change for a lot of people. And yeah, it kind of surprised me when I found that out.
So the practical impact of this for folks is they get their blood pressure taken, and where previously it would have been we're going to keep an eye on this. This is a little higher than we like to see. Now the response is we need to talk about medication. We need to talk about lifestyle changes. We need to talk about taking action and doing something about it. There are a lot of different actions that can be taken, though.
There is lots of things you can do. You're right. And it's always better to start making a change before there are problems. Right. One of Amy and I's big jobs is we promote prevention over disease. If we can prevent the disease, then we don't have to manage the disease. And there's lots of things you can do. And we've heard some of them all before, right? Lose weight if you're overweight, eat a healthy diet, exercise, you know.
You make it sound so fun.
We've heard some of those before. But it doesn't have to be big and it doesn't have to be hard. You know, little changes can really make a big impact.
I always like hearing stuff like that because this stuff does feel big and it does feel hard. Amy, I'd cut you off there. What were you going to say?
It is such an overwhelming thing when you think about all of those things together that you, quote, should be doing, right? So when we think about sustainable change, we like to look at it as how do we take these big, overwhelming jobs or tasks and break them down into smaller, doable steps. Really, we like to look at what's the one action that I have control over that I can do today to help me get towards that healthy model of health and well-being where I see myself.
Yeah. And to take that a little bit further, Amy, what's the one thing that I can do today and keep doing? Because consistency is really so key. Right? If you can only change one thing, make it something that you can change and stay with. I think of New Year's resolutions. Everyone's like, I'm going to go to the gym every day and I'm going to do this and that. And when it's new and shiny for a couple weeks, but then you slip once, right? And then, oh, well, I didn't go today because I, you know, don't feel good or my car broke down or whatever. And then it just slides. Big changes are really hard to keep doing. But if you can do one little change, I'm going to drink a glass of water before I eat my breakfast. I'm going to rinse off the canned vegetables that I'm adding to dinner to lower the sodium. The little things that you can keep doing then become a habit, and then you can target a new thing. And the consistency, just doing it over and over again, is so very important.
Are there good places to start? Things that might feel good or really good early on and are easier to maintain? Or is it really just take your pick and see where I lead you?
I think the latter. I think for folks who do something because they feel that they have to, it can be a struggle. I don't know about you, but I've got that rebellious inner teenager that still says, I'm not going to do that just because you told me to. So part of success comes from autonomy, being able to make the choice for ourselves. So whether or not it's going to be the best first step that you could take to improve your blood pressure, I would be less significant than the first thing that you feel the most excited about. Because if it feels good to you, you're going to want to keep doing it. And then you're going to want to do more. And it has a really positive snowball effect. Not to get into a winter analogy, but you're going to build a nice, handsome snowman by the time you're done. But you've got to find the steps that are important to you. And one thing that can be really helpful is connecting those steps to something that you value. We talk about kids. I got to be able to keep up with my kids. For a lot of folks, I've got to keep up with my grandkids. I want to be around to see them grow up and graduate high school. And that's what's really important to a lot of the people that I talk to. So making small steps that can help you focus on those things can also make it kind of more, to Vicky's point, to keep it going, to stay motivated.
I think part of what you're talking about there is accountability, right? Keeping up with your kid, being there for your grandchildren, that's something you're doing for yourself for sure, but for another person too. I'm a big accountability person when it comes to lifestyle changes. The best shape that I was ever in my entire life, which is well over a decade ago now, it happened because I started going to the gym every single day with a friend, and that friend was really dedicated and kind of pulled me along with them. If it feels good and you can stick to it, you can really make some big changes.
Even if that person is not on the same journey as you, because everyone's journey is a little different, maybe your friend, coworker, spouse, family member, pseudo stranger on the street, new neighbor, whatever, maybe they aren't where you are, but having someone that's kind of in your corner, maybe pulling you along, maybe cheering you on, maybe guilting you on. I mean, let's be honest, that works for me. I'm sorry to say, what gets measured gets done, right? And if someone's looking at it, I'm more likely to do that because I know I have to report out about it. Kind of like when we do action plans, Amy, in the workshop, I know I have to report on it. I know someone's going to check in about it. Hey, how's your new gym routine going? You know, having someone with you can really help. I had this couple in one of my workshops. she does the cooking. He has high blood pressure. So it was important that they were on the same page. She was like, well, my blood pressure is fine, but I need to learn how to support him because you're in this journey together. And so it just was so nice to know that they had the support of each other.
If you find somebody in your life like that, hang on to them, because I know plenty of loving couples who don't take that approach.
And then there's plenty of folks out there who think about it and I don't have anybody. I might have people in my life that love me, but they don't get what I'm going through. This happens a lot with the folks that we work with who live with chronic pain. They feel really isolated because their loved ones don't have that empathy for what they're living with. And with any chronic condition, it's great to have somebody who gets it. And sometimes one of the biggest challenges is finding somebody that can be in your life, that can provide you that support and accountability.
You're making a change. Change is uncomfortable. I know very few people for whom change is not uncomfortable. And if you have to go through something uncomfortable, maybe that's the time to strike up a little conversation with the person you see when you're walking around the block every day. Maybe you strike up a conversation with that person that always seems to be coming the other way, or someone you kind of know but don't know really well. It can be an opportunity to expand your social circle. It's harder to make friends when we're adults. It's really easy when you're a kid. But we could all use bigger social circles, I think. And you don't know, maybe that person at the gym is on a similar or tangential journey to yours. And then you just made a new friend and an accountability partner because you want to make sure to show up for that person. Right?
No one else.
Because you haven't known them for 30 years already. You can't let each other slide if it's a new relationship. You got to show up.
What really helps a lot of folks too is, dare I say it, technology. If you aren't quite as ready to befriend the gym rat that you know, the smartwatch community can be a great place to sign up for challenges. So you're challenging yourself, you're sort of checking in, there's other people. It's a good way to dip your toe into some accountability partners. There's also Come Alive Outside, which is a great Vermont resource. They've got challenges for walking a mile a day for 30 days, I think was one that we did, maybe 100 days. It's a great local resource.
What other resources are out there? We've talked a lot about accountability and social interactions, whether they're online or in person. Are there resources that are specifically about nutrition, specifically about other aspects of blood pressure health or heart health that you want to call out for folks?
We have some great programs that are available to Vermonters. They are led by Vermonters. They are evidence-based, which means they're proven to be effective. So a lot of the evidence shows that people are just feeling more in control of their healthcare management and they feel less depressed. They are exercising more. The six different programs focus all on lifestyle and how that can help you to be an active self-manager. And believe it or not, they all very much focus on action planning, which takes us back to those small, sustainable steps that we talked about and the accountability. You know, these workshops are peer-led. They're led by people who've walked the walk, who also are trying to live their healthiest life. And our leaders are great role models for folks who are trying to get that for themselves.
Those are the My Healthy Vermont workshops. These are workshops that are free for all Vermonters or people living and receiving care in Vermont. It's funded by a grant, so there are no income or insurance questions. We've really tried to remove as many barriers as possible because we know with behavior change, the more barriers there are, the harder it is to make a change. Right. We talked about Come Alive Outside, which is another great free local program. But, you know, one thing that's hard, especially these days, for everything's more expensive, accessing healthy food can be a challenge. It's easy to say, oh, you need to eat healthier and eat fresh fruits and vegetables. But where do you get those? How do you afford those? Because you still need to pay for your medication. Because really, taking your medication the way your doctor prescribes is important in managing blood pressure or chronic conditions. it can be hard to do all the things, and it can get expensive to do all the things you hear people touting. So knowing about the resources in your particular area, food shelves, the Veggie Van Gogh, the food bank, SNAP benefits, if you qualify for those, we're heading into farmers market season, which is one of my favorite seasons. Your SNAP benefits, your dollars get doubled at the farmers market. So your $10 benefit is actually $20 worth of vegetables at the farmers market under those programs. So that can be a really great way to stretch the dollar. I also think social connection is huge. It's hard to be isolated. And even though we have technology and all these things, people are getting more isolated. So if you are able to make a connection, make a plan, get creative. That benefits everybody.
We'll link to these resources that Amy and Vicky are talking about in the episode descriptions. So if you're listening to this as a podcast, check that out. Click the links, learn more about these programs and whether they can support you and whether they're available for you.
A great resource that we can also include is the American Heart Association's Life's Essential 8. It's the 8 essential lifestyle habits that they recommend to help have a healthy heart. And what I wanted to point out is that also at least 5 or 6 of the 8 are directly, maybe all 8 actually, are directly represented in our My Healthy Vermont programs. Our hypertension program will cover at least 6 out of the 8. And then our chronic disease workshop, it's called Chronic Disease Self-Management. It will cover all 8 of those topics. So if you're not sure where to begin, I would invite you to think about joining one of our programs. We've got some starting up in the middle of the summer or early this summer and kind of later into the summer that folks can get signed up for. As Vicky pointed out, because of these wonderful grants in Vermont, we have access to these workshops at no cost. You can check out our website. The dates and times will be on there.
This one's going to make me really unpopular with some people. It's not an easy way to start, but I wanted to throw out that if someone is a smoker, the number one biggest impact you can have on your health for any chronic disease, if you're a smoker, is to reduce or quit. It's not an easy thing, but it is worth it. And we have supports and workshops that can help you with that. There are folks that do counseling that can help with that. There are a lot of programs that can help with that. I just want to call that out because smoking does increase blood pressure. It impacts diabetes. Having high blood pressure and low blood flow combined with diabetes and the slow healing because of poor perfusion can lead to a lot of really big problems. And it impacts every chronic disease, really. So just throwing that out there. And like I said, it's going to be an unpopular one.
As a 43-year-old who is the son of a mother who has smoked a pack a day at least for 40-plus years, all I can say is Vicky is preaching to the choir here. Like, there's nothing that's more important and nothing that's harder than that.
The hard change, how good does that feel when you reach that mountain? I mean, it feels hard at first and you look back, you're like, why didn't I do this sooner? A lot of people I talk to say, I wish I'd done it sooner. I wish I never started, specifically with smoking. But we can't go back and change that. We can change today. So don't wait another minute. If you're feeling motivated by this, you're like, oh, maybe I could. Don't do it alone. I think that's what we're saying is it is hard. It can be. It doesn't have to be painful. There's plans. There's support. There's resources. And we want to work with you.
It's time for a quick break here on Living Healthy Together. When we come back, we'll talk about how social determinants or social drivers of health make a huge impact on high blood pressure and the people who are trying to manage this chronic condition. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Living Healthy Together, where we're talking about high blood pressure. There's a lot to talk about. And one of my favorite aspects of almost any health conversation is social determinants of health, social drivers of health. It's about how who you are, where you live, and things like how much money you make impact your health and wellness and your ability to make positive impacts on your own health and wellness. I'm pleased to welcome Guadalupe Martinez, the Director of Culture, Experience, and Community Health for UVM Health, and Aaron Armstrong, a licensed clinical social worker and the Director of Health Equity for UVM Health. Thank you both for joining us. You're experts in these topics across a wide range of health concerns. Heart-related health problems and health impacts are extremely impacted by health-related social needs and social drivers of health. Why is that?
As you mentioned, we usually think about hypertension as a medical thing, but it is much bigger. It's actually tied to health-related social needs. So when we think of social determinants of health, that's kind of like a population level systemic environmental factors that we're born into. And then the health-related social needs are really how those translate into a person's individual lives. So it's the non-medical factors that would influence a person's health and well-being. Basically, the everyday stuff that shapes how we live.
Talk a little bit about your different roles in this space.
I think both Aaron and I, we try to explore what are the barriers, social barriers across our health system, the gaps that are unseen, basically. And we try to close those gaps. So, for example, I do a lot of work on the education piece of things. Where we come in is, how do you look at every patient as an individual? How, if you're going to tell somebody eat healthier, but that person has to go back home to be the caregiver to their 70, 80-year-old parent, they have to care for their families, they have to work two or three jobs to make ends meet. It is so easy to fall into this trap, I think, as health providers and clinicians and everything in between when you're serving, to say, well, you know what you need to do. You need to eat healthier, you need to exercise, but my life looks really difficult. Where do I fit that in? How do I start buying fresh veggies and fruit when the closest grocery to me is 50 minutes away and my car isn't always reliable?
Libby and I work alongside each other, and we're really looking at addressing those systems that cause the inequities, looking to leverage the work of our community partners that are the experts in food security or housing. As we know, all of those really impact the overall picture of health for our patients and our communities. So it's about thinking about how we can do business a little differently and make different choices to really be able to get good data. And when we identify disparities, be able to act on those.
So do we know right now what the most meaningful or impactful social drivers of health are vis-a-vis high blood pressure? Do we know what's more impactful and what's less?
Well, they all play a role in it. So when we think about hypertension, you've heard people say, oh, well, the stress is raising my blood pressure. Well, that is actually true, right? It's the stress from the daily life. It's not just necessarily big events, but the stress of not having enough money to make ends meet or to buy healthy foods, or it's having housing that's not adequate. It's not enough for everybody to have the space they need, or it's unsafe in some ways. It's job insecurity. It's transportation. It's kind of all of those things. The low level pressure and the accumulation of that stress actually does create actual physical pressure in your body. And so we can't say just one major contributor. They all play a hand in creating that stressful environment for a person.
What are the most important investments you think need to be made or absolutely should be made to address these impacts that people feel from their everyday lives and who they are?
That's a great question. I think for years, our systems have worked against certain populations of people and created poverty and racism. And those are just built in now to the fabric of our societies, unfortunately. And so it's going to take years of work. But I think some of the efforts that are happening right now is really just making sure that we are screening people that come in for those social needs and getting an understanding of the picture of what people are experiencing in our own communities, making sure we're connecting folks to resources and really thinking about treating the whole person, not just their blood pressure. And I know that healthcare systems are starting to realize that and change how they do business. And if we want to be sustainable as a hospital and really have the healthiest communities, we really have to think about things in that way. I mentioned a few minutes ago investing in the work of our community partners and sort of being at the table with them as thought partners, but also really leveraging the work that they do and using our own power and influence to advocate for resources and systemic change. We're a big healthcare organization, so we do have a lot of power and presence in the community. And how can we use that for good? And just kind of thinking about things in those ways will help impact our communities in a way that will ultimately lead to people being healthier.
I do want to mention two investments that have been made. One is the Healthcare Anchor Mission program. Can you talk about what that is, why that's important?
Healthcare Anchor Network is a national association of healthcare organizations that really band together and sign on for specific strategies that do kind of just what I was mentioning, you know, really committing to doing things in a different way that's really hyper-focused on purchasing local, hiring locally, how we can build a presence of overall health and wellness in our communities, and kind of thinking about all the ways we give back and show up for certain communities that we know that are disadvantaged, and just creating more opportunities to reduce the disparity between those that have access and resources and those that don't. There's hundreds of different ways we do that as an organization. Some of them are investing in creating opportunities for folks that may not necessarily be able to access capital or grants to do things like start businesses or even afford housing and things like that. Making sure we know which of our communities in our health service area are more disadvantaged. You know, there are certain zip codes, as you mentioned, that we know have the least amount of access to a lot of things. And so how are we focusing our supports to them? And are we creating some intentional hiring pathways in those communities and different things like that?
How does a healthcare organization navigate that? You have a finite amount of resources, whether that's people, time, money. You can only invest in so many things. It's got to be a really, really difficult thing to navigate.
Yeah, it is. And of course, there are not enough resources to go around. The system has been incredibly lucky that we were gifted some money, and also we've been able to invest a little bit of money in those community programs to help advance some of that work. There's a lot of great collaborative work going on in different, we call them accountable communities for health over New York. They have great relationships with the Adirondack Rural Health Network and different networks that are really just looking at all these things together and how we can build a more unified system and align across those systems for our patients and communities.
Lupe, the other investment that I was thinking about is a pair of screening events that happened at Central Vermont Medical Center and at the Public Library in Berlin in early May. You were a part of those events. Why was that a focus for your team and for Central Vermont?
This hypertension awareness event really came out of Central Vermont's Diversity, Equity, Inclusion Committee. And we were really trying to tie in how do we start addressing some of those real gaps and disparities that our community in CVMC area is facing. And luckily, as part of this group, we have some clinical providers that see the real impact of people not having access to what might seem simple to us. It's a really big deal to those folks that really don't have access to high blood pressure test screenings or A1C testing for potential diabetes. And so I want to send a little shout out to two folks, Emily Byrne, who's a nurse practitioner with family medicine in the CVMC area, and Rachel Lorick, who's a director of nutrition services at CVMC. They mentioned, hey, we have this really great opportunity to start closing the gap on by doing blood pressure screenings. So about 6 months ago or so, we said, who do we need to reach the most? Who is it that needs the most support in our community? And we quickly realized there's a lot of education resources out there, but the piece that's missing is how do you increase access to the, if I find out I have high blood pressure, who do I go to? What are my resources? I have no idea where to even start. I have to go back to work after this, or I have to go take care of my kids or my family or my parents. Am I going to be okay? All of those questions come up for a person. And then when they don't have access to the what's after, that's where we continue falling into that loop of disparities. So when we got together, said, we can't do this all by ourselves. How do we start connecting to different community organizations that already doing work in this space, maybe already have resources? So from that, we partnered with different community organizations, Vermont Department of Health, 802 Quits, My Healthy Vermont, Hunger Free Vermont, People's Health and Wellness. And we held two screenings, one at CVMC and one at the Aldrich Library. And we said, let's not only provide education and resources and contact to people, but let's help them get signed up. If they need access to local fruits and vegetables, let's get them plugged in right now. And then we also tied in folks who came back with high blood pressure. We said, would you like a little bit more further support? If you don't have already a provider, do you want support with connecting you to somebody right now? Let's get you in for an appointment, or let's get you somebody that can get you in for an appointment, either through our CVMC clinics or with our primary care or through the People's Health and Wellness Clinic. Between the two sessions, we screened over 80 community members. So that means that there is a need, there is a want. People want to take care of themselves, but don't always have an opportunity to do so, don't have access all in one place. So we really tried to create everything that we could have resources, like a one-stop shop for folks that led them to a better access to care after the fact.
There are going to be folks that are listening right now and say, 80 people, that's not that many people. But think about how many people that is that were motivated to drive, to travel somewhere, to get their blood pressure checked, and take time out of their day to go do this, to get a screening. That's a significant number of folks that were willing to make a time investment to go do this. But then it's not just high blood pressure screening. It's food resources. It's social resources. It's all of these other things that could be impacting people's cardiovascular health. Getting all of that together in a one-stop shop is incredibly complex. And it had to have been a really proud moment for you guys to pull it off and to have such a great reception in the community. Let's talk a little bit about generational trends, new things that we're seeing, areas of focus moving forward. Lupe, this is something you're passionate about and work in the community on. What are you seeing and hearing, new trends or things that you're taking notice of?
I see a little bit of everything, but in the spirit of transparency, budgets are just getting tighter for folks across every single generation, right? Regardless if you're a Gen Zer, which means you're in the group of like your younger 20s and maybe younger 30s to millennials and then Gen Xers and boomers, we're seeing every single person being impacted by the economy. And so some of the trends that have been popping up and that I've been watching and seeing across different social media sites, such as TikTok, has been, how do you spend the least amount of money on making meals? And so, for example, I follow this person online that has become really popular within the last 6 months to a year that shares 1 minute videos on how you can make $5 meals for a family of four or five and everything you can find at either a Dollar Tree, Dollar General, which means typically in those stores, the only access you really have to the different types of food are either ones that are canned, that are jarred, or that are frozen. You really won't see those fresh vegetables or fruit. But because times are tough, people are looking for ways to make their dollar stretch the most that they can for their families. And so thinking about what's the most nutritious will be put in the back burner, and it's going to be, what can I feed my family with? And the trends I've been seeing is these types of practices of how I can reduce my spending the most, including in my meals and other practical needs that I have, has exploded within the past year or so. Some comments that I see on there include stories of people saying things like, you know, I just retired and I don't know what my future looks like, but these videos have kept me fed for a few meals at a time because I'm able to afford $4 for two meals in one day. Or we always say when the economy gets tough, it's get let go of the luxury. But what we're seeing more now, regardless of the generation, is people are turning to saving a dollar in their most practical and basic needs that you have, whether it's housing, whether it's food, and meals, all the things that we need to survive as humans and as individuals.
That's a great place to leave it here on Living Healthy Together, High Blood Pressure. Erin Armstrong, Director of Health Equity for UVM Health, Guadalupe Martinez, Culture Experience and Community Health Director for UVM Health. Thank you both so much for joining us today. Thank you to all of our guests. I'm your host, Philip Rao. We'll see you next time.